Greetings, Thrill Shriekers. I'm Elizabeth Irwin.
I'm Gwen Hoffman.
I'm Dawn Keatley.
And on today's episode of Horror Homeroom Conversations, we're adding some schlock to our shock by reconsidering the Creepshow franchise. Beloved and reviled in equal measure for its decidedly campy love letter to EC horror comics of the 1950s, Creepshow is arguably still the standard for cinematic anthology horror. But should it be? We're debating the franchise's legacy and why the films still make our hearts go flopsy when we contemplate your sweet autopsy. So stay tuned.
That is amazing, Liz.
I really hope someone gets that reference besides you, but I don't think they will.
I greatly appreciate that introduction, and I almost felt like we had to introduce, like, a Crypt Keeper character in honor of that. Even though that's a different franchise, I just feel like it would have been amazing.
I do love a good Crypt Keeper, but it has been a minute since we've done this. So let's see. Dawn's been doing international conferences, planning, and fabulously.
One of them.
Gwen has been, like, saving the environment.
Oh, is that? That's my claim to fame.
For, like, a week.
Yes.
I've been watching Real Housewives of Potomac. So things are happening, guys. But I'm actually really happy that we're here, and we're going to be talking about Creepshow today. We thought we would start by going in order of the franchise. So we're going to start with 1982's Creepshow, directed by George A. Romero and written by Stephen King. And I guess we'll start by talking about what's your favorite story from the anthology, because I'm very curious.
Oh, see, I don't feel like it would be a secret which would be my favorite.
Father's Day?
Yes. Yeah. Out of the five tales, Father's Day is wholeheartedly my favorite out of them.
Okay. Do you have any other favorites, like, or one that you hate?
I think that if I had to pick a second runner-up, I liked The Crate.
Okay.
As far as what I didn't love, I'm not a huge fan of the lonesome death of Jordy Hill, or Jordy Verrill, I'm sorry. That's not my favorite of them. But yeah, so okay. That's me.
That's a place to start, so we'll be interrogating the whys of all of that. I had never seen this film before, though I had watched the Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill segment. And I think my favorite was Something to Tide You Over. I thought that was surprisingly creepy and actually kind of interesting. Like, it was the only one of the segments, and I have very different criteria from Gwen. Not much into the campy part of things, but Something to Tide You Over actually kind of made me think afterwards.
It's so. Kind of a pathological death, too. Like,
it's great.
I'll give credit where credit is due. That was pretty well thought out and...
Yes.
Super
planning.
Crazy. Not as gory as I like, but again, I'll give credit. It's...
Yeah.
Creepy.
I didn't get to see the last segment, but I feel like the other segments, they're all more camp than horror. Like, even with the monster in the crate. Yeah. I can see why you like them, Gwen.
Yeah. I can. So, I'll give you that.
Liz.
Yeah. Well, my favorite by far is Something to Tide You Over.
I love
that story. My least favorite is probably They're Creeping Up on You, even though I still think it's really interesting. So, but yeah, Something to Tide You Over, Leslie Nielsen. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get better.
And Ted Danson.
Yeah, they play well off of each other. And what I love about the Ted Danson moment is because you know now that, like, he wore a toupee. So every time I see, like, the water start to come over, I'm like, am I going to see the glue? Am I going to? And I never do, and it's disappointing. But I do enjoy that.
You're right. It is probably one of the scarier ones of them. Because, again, most people, if you ask them, like, ways that they would absolutely not want to die. Now, nobody really wants to die, let's be honest, but, you know, burning, drowning.
But drowning is so peaceful. You just literally fall asleep. If you can deal with the panic.
If my pause was audible right now, you guys, like, my jaw is what? Peaceful?
Yes.
Grasping for air? Gurgling? Choking?
Listen, it's temporary because your brain starts to fog. So you're not really having the reaction that you would have as a person sitting here thinking about it.
No, I think
practice,
she'd really actually have that reaction.
I know.
The gasping.
Well, I don't know if Ted Danson would agree with you.
But it happens
don't
so
worry,
quickly.
Don't worry, if you don't struggle, you might be able to get out.
It happens so quickly. I'm just saying. I will die
Let's
on this
Let's test
hill.
This out. You know what? Right before, like, they do the sand castles for the Sea Witch Festival down in Rehoboth, we're going to go down, we're going to bury you in the sand, I'll put it on video, it'll be great. You're going to love it. It's going to be peaceful. It's going to be so relaxing and grounding.
I can hold my breath really long, so I have no problem.
Okay, it'll be a long experiment.
Well, in fairness, though, when the wife, you start to see the video footage, like, her shoulders are free at that point. She was just not working for it because she should have been able to do this to get out. I'm just saying that's a flaw.
Maybe if she was a true 80s woman and wore big shoulder pads, hell, that would help her get out, too.
Well, for audience members who don't know what the hell is going on right now.
We should probably go story by story, right?
We can do that. But we can talk out of order with this one.
But this one, basically, the plot is that Leslie Nielsen buries his cheating wife and her lover, Ted Danson, up to their heads in the sand. And then waits while the tide comes in and drowns them. He watches it on TV. And he makes Ted Danson watch his lovers drowning on TV. And it's definitely one of the most creative deaths ever. If I was making a creative death list, it would have to be on it. So that's what that segment is about.
My question is in this case, is just kind of subjectivity too. Because I know a lot of times people want to just vilify the cheating spouse or whatever like that. But this is one of the few segments even in this that I think that your allegiance goes back to the woman, do you think? Because Leslie Nielsen, I don't think that there was much to align with him in this. Maybe it's just me. No? Maybe not.
Maybe I'm trying to think my response could be used in a court case down the line. Like, she was pathological. I found myself identifying with him, but I think because of the camp elements.
Leslie Nielsen.
Right. Okay. Because it was just an enjoyable performance. Not his plight, so to speak. But I enjoyed him as a character, so I wanted to see him push it even further.
Okay. No, I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just surprised.
But I feel like the gender dynamics you're talking about, like, that definitely is evident, I would say, in all of them.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I was a little biased by having read Gwen's fantastic post on this. All of these episodes, well, I don't know about the one I didn't watch. All of these segments are really gendered, and they're really about male power.
Yeah.
Like, it's really striking. Misogyny, male power, and there seems to be an episode seem to push a little bit against male power, but it seems like it always wins in the end, right? That was kind of the point you were making.
And that's what always makes me think about, because it was in Stephen King's book, Dance Macabre or whatever, and which was much later.
Yeah.
But that he says, you know, horror is as, you know, what, conservative as a three-piece suit. And how,
a Republican
in a three-piece suit, yes. And it is true, because you do see it really just kind of, you know, you see some transgression, but it's always reeled back in all of these pieces, which makes sense because it was early 80s. Mm-hmm. So they were probably dealing with whatever challenges to male authority, specifically white male authority, and kind of reeling that back in.
And three of the episodes really specifically deal with women who have challenged men in some way. I mean, in Father's Day, Adelia kills her father. In Something to Tide You Over, Leslie Nielsen's wife cheats on him. And then in The Crate, we have the shrew, who is constantly ordering her husband around. So we have these women, and they're maybe in three different ways. They're kind of, you know, representative of, like, early 80s feminism, I guess. Mm-hmm. None of them really come to very good ends, do they?
No. But you definitely, in your post, which is probably the best thing I've read on Creepshow.
Yes.
Well, thank you, because I reread it, and I felt like it was all over the place. which is pretty consistent for me, but hey.
But I really like your point about fathers, because that's something that, and you do a really good job tracking that throughout the series.
Yeah, some of the quotes throughout the film are pretty overt.
Oh, yeah. Well, the framing narrative. Yeah.
Right. The prologue, because it starts with, like, the prologue, then there's the five stories, and then there's the epilogue. And the prologue really does introduce the notion of, like, the father as a super problematic character. So in the prologue, we meet Billy, a young comic fan whose love for a comic titled Creepshow raises the ire of his father, Stan. And he's confined to his room and wishing death on his father. And Billy sees the creep and he comes to the window. And it's so well done, especially for the 80s. And he's, like, beckoning him to come forward. And then that's when we segue into Father's Day. And as Dawn mentioned, Father's Day tracks Bedelia, who's returning to, like, quote unquote, the scene of the crime because her father, I think, killed her lover.
Yes.
And so
And then she
Bedelia. There's just a lot there. Yeah.
Over the head. Yeah.
Even going back, though, to that prologue, like just to kind of bring out quotes, like I wrote down some of them. You have the father. He's saying, remember who puts the friggin' bread on this table? And they say, that's why God made fathers, babe. And so it's setting that stage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just as a side note, the boy who plays Billy is Stephen King's son.
That's right.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Joe Hill, the writer.
Oh, my.
So, but he's obviously not a writer at this point. He's very little. but he grew up to be Joe Hill, the writer.
Pause for thought.
I am.
On a sidebar, though, can I tell you what I love about these little comic book caveats that happen throughout all these films? And I know that they're taking you back to those EC comics from the 50s. Mm-hmm. And I didn't grow up a comic book girl. I never was. But I grew up a horror magazine girl. So it just even, like, the little ads that are in the comic books, it just reminds me of, like, how excited I would be to get that Fangoria magazine.
Right.
Shout out to Fangoria, you know.
Right.
How excited I was to get that and to see the different ads that were in there for monster masks and, you know, severed hands and heads and eyes and limbs and, like, magic tricks and things like Venus flytraps. Mm-hmm. And you were so excited for those things. And you bought into it, too. You're like, yes, I need to have, you know, a Venus flytrap right now and some jumping beans because I'm going to bury them in my backyard and crazy stuff. I just loved that about this.
Did you ever buy anything?
Oh, yes. Of course I did.
I did buy a voodoo doll, which maybe we'll get there. But it didn't work quite as well, though.
I usually bought limbs. That was usually what I would buy.
What would you do with the limbs?
I don't know. They were just strewn about. Yes. They were just strewn about. It's so funny because my good friend Chrissy, she was also like me and she would buy these things. And one day, you know, she went on to buy a house and she was hoping to sell that house at one point. And she had to take all of her, like, heads and arms and limbs and put them into this closet because, of course, it doesn't show well when people come to view your home.
Really?
And, of course, somebody opens up this closet filled with limbs as they spill out. And it just, it makes me,
that's
it
when
warms
the FBI came into the story.
It warms my heart because she is also that girl that would quote, you know, the hitchhiker skit with me, too, that's from Creepshow, too. But, so, yes, this was our childhood.
That's a lot. That's a lot.
But a voodoo doll.
Well, what can I tell you? No, I was just curious because you said that you liked Father's Day the best.
Yeah.
And I was curious what it was about Father's Day that really stands out to you.
Loved Bedelia. I mean, they called her a spinster, which, I don't know. I mean, I guess because she was single, but she wasn't single by choice. Her father killed her husband.
The subsequent not getting involved with anyone was probably her choice. Or was she so traumatized that she was unable?
Oh, there's our dollar words now.
Drink, people, drink.
Yes. No, I don't know. I liked that she kind of said enough's enough. And she killed him. So I guess we should kind of mention what happens in this section.
So she basically comes, as is her yearly pilgrimage, and she's sitting at her father's grave, and she's got the alcohol, and she's sort of pouring it out and railing against him and everything that he's done and basically saying, like, I beat you.
Mm-hmm.
And then who should emerge from the grave but her father, who still wants his cake.
Yeah.
Because you see in flashbacks that what sent her over the edge was him sitting there like a petulant child saying, I want my cake, Bedelia.
Yeah.
And which is interesting because if you think about it, in the end, petulance completely gets rewarded. And
what is that actor's name? Because he was in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. And all I think about is the blessing.
John Lormer. So, I don't know what else he was in.
Oh,
all I could do was focus on a young Ed Harris and that very strange dance.
Oh, yes.
That he and his wife, Carrie Nye, in the movie. I don't understand the point of that, but.
But it's just so funny.
Awesome. He was so young.
The father is the one that kind of, you know, is the monster in the end, comes back and, you know, offs Bedelia.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of wins. But, like, he was a horrible, miserable, disgusting creature
in
life. So,
absolutely.
I mean, he made his money from what? Bootlegging, fraud, extortion, and murder. So he was not a nice guy. He had all kinds of money. I mean, you picture in the film, it looks like those paintings that you see in hotels in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got...
Not Connecticut.
Yes. Get out of here. You see people wearing riding boots and having dogs with trout hanging out of their mouth or ducks or something weird like that. And it's all dimly lit and smoking coats. And
but it's very curious that the sign is coded as gay, I think, in a really bizarre 1980s explicit kind of way for no purpose whatsoever, which except to be swishy.
He didn't really have to be reeled in either, which because you would consider him a threat in 1982.
Yeah.
But maybe it was the bigger threat was less the homosexual son than it was this masculine woman.
Yeah, and she was masculine. Like, at first, when the episode started, and, you know, we hear that Bedelia is coming for her annual visit on Father's Day, and she's driving along in the car, I actually had kind of a moment of gender confusion. I was like,
yeah,
wait, is she the father? Like, she looks like a woman. I mean, and I was just, like, confused. And I maybe that was purposeful because, you know, part of Bedelia's character is to be this kind of masculine threat to her father because he kills her and he kills Ed Harris.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And maybe Ed Harris's wife.
Oh, Sylvia, her head winds up on the platter.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
But what I found interesting this go around was it seems to me the exact same plot as Uncle Simon in the Twilight Zone.
I was going to ask you that.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Liz, what Twilight episode does this remind you of?
The whole time I'm watching it, I'm like, how have I never put this together? Yeah. It is basically Uncle Simon.
It's Uncle Simon,
and a really interesting way. And so I'm very curious now, knowing that Stephen King... I'll tweet him because I'm sure he'll answer me. I'm like,
of course.
Did you rip off Twilight Zone?
Yeah. Well, I was just looking up the actor who played John Lormer, who played the father, and he actually, it doesn't say which episodes, but he was in the Twilight Zone.
Oh.
It would be very interesting if he actually did play Uncle Simon.
Oh my goodness.
Check that out.
I will be Googling that post-haste.
There's an article there, Liz.
Oh my
Simon
goodness.
And Father's Day.
I'm glad you saw it too, because I sometimes wonder when I watch these things, I'm like, am I just crazy and read stuff into things?
But... Well, it was particularly the I want my cake repetition, that sort of petulant, like, child. The child patriarch combined.
And the fact that they're the last one standing.
Yeah.
And that these poor spinster women are utterly destroyed
by these men. Just won't die.
Right.
Really, like,
very upsetting.
In both the Twilight Zone episode and this, they go on after death, but in different ways. You know, the Twilight Zone, this horrible uncle, I think, becomes embodied in a robot, and here it's a corpse.
So, do we have any allegiances in this segment? Because this is one of the few segments that has a lot more people in it. Because, you know, you go into the next one, there's not a ton of characters and things like that. So I didn't know if there was...
I mean, I did legitimately feel badly for Ed Harris because I thought all this dude wants to do is, like, dance and drink. And suddenly he's got, you know, a headstone falling on him and crushing him. Especially when two of the... Like, actual lineage, are left standing. I mean, I guess the implication is that they're about to die as well.
Or maybe not. Maybe it is because he's a heterosexual male that he has to die. Threat to the father's power.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Literally,
you know,
crushed.
He was concerned from the grave who was going to kind of carry on that legacy, so.
And the fact that he is killed with Bedelia and put, like, in a grave with Bedelia, I think is pretty interesting as well. Because that masculine threat is complete. Yeah, exactly. Is completely obliterated by the death of those two.
I think when I had previously watched this, what I liked about the segment is just how it plays with gender and power. And that always intrigues me. And just, of course, family dynamics, that intrigues me. But I think even, too, going back and watching it, having had to have been a caretaker at some point in my life, oh, God, my family's turning over in their grave right now. But you have those moments when you want to take a marble ashtray and just end it
100%.
All. And it's like You do.
Yes, you do.
And I think that in that moment when he was demanding, because he kept talking about, you're supposed to be taking care of me. You're supposed to be doing this for me. You know, and he keeps taking and taking and taking. And again, when you're older and you're frail, you kind of return to some of that egocentric state. And I get it, but it's hard. And you got to hide the ashtrays.
So clearly you identified with Bedelia.
Yeah, I did.
The ashtray-wielding caretaker.
Absolutely. And she drinks some good stuff.
She sure does.
Her first mistake is she never should have spilled it.
Yeah.
None of this would have happened if she didn't spill it.
I mean, she is the only character to identify with, but, you know, it's a short segment in a shortish film. I'm not sure invested. It was developed enough for me to feel for her. But, I mean, hearing you talk about her, I'm like, poor Bedelia.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that brings us to the lonesome death of Jordy Verrill.
I think we probably said more about Father's Day than anyone's ever said.
There's
very little written on these films.
Which is odd for how much they are liked, which we were talking about. Yeah. I mean, they're highly rated. Everybody enjoys these.
To give you guys a little bit of a synopsis, when a meteorite crashes into his backyard, country bumpkin Jordy is overrun with weeds, quite literally, when he comes in contact with the meteor's strange leaking goo. I think that pretty
sums it up.
And we should note that Stephen King plays the titular character. He's not a thespian. I think we can probably all agree. But he does have a certain charm to him, though, for this role. No?
No.
Okay.
Well, I have to say, this is the only one of these segments that's based on a story by Stephen King called Weeds, which I read recently. And it's a good story. And it's a good story because the main character isn't a joke like Jordy Verrill is in this. I mean, he's just a buffoon.
Yeah.
He never seems to realize the seriousness of what's happening to him. I mean, in the short story, there's like terror on the part of the main character that like this green stuff is growing on his right eye. And, you know, you get into his interior. Here's just some like doofus who doesn't even seem bothered really that he's getting covered with grass.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thing that bothered me, it's sort of taking off of that, is that it really makes a point of if you're lower class and haven't had access to like traditional education. I don't know. There was like a lot of class stuff happening here.
He was a farmer, wasn't he?
But he kept saying, I only need $200 to pay off my bank loan.
Yeah.
And then he would have these like fantasies of going into like the academic institution and presenting his finding of this great meteor. And in one sort of fantasy, he's rewarded. He gets his $200. He can, you know, pay off his loan. And then the other, they're like making fun of him. And I felt like, well, that's what we're doing as audience members, like our spectatorship.
Now I feel really bad.
I was doing it too, though. I think that's what you're supposed to do. I mean, it's completely set up to have that response. At least that's what I told myself to make myself feel better. But I did have that response.
I think I would like this segment better if I had read the short story. Because what you're talking about, the short story, sounds amazing. Side note, I didn't even think about it until you just said it, about him having these fantasies about presenting things, you know, in front of an academic audience. Academia comes up again.
Oh, yeah.
Throughout. So I wonder if that's going to be something that has a larger theme. Because we talk about gender.
Yes.
But interestingly enough, too, academia is in there.
Yeah.
So we'll have to revisit.
It's a viper pit. That's why. But we'll get there.
Tell me how you really feel.
So obviously we're dealing with weeds and we're dealing with like a sort of contagion. I mean, it did bring to mind some eco horror for me.
Yeah.
Like legitimately. Not.
Yeah. No, it really did to me. Perhaps more now than in 1980. Mostly the very end where Jordy Verrill has shot himself, but the segment doesn't end there. It pulls back to a kind of apocalyptic shot of the landscape and the roads leading to various towns in Maine. And there's a voiceover on the radio. The current 30-day forecast released by the U.S. Meteorological Station in Portland calls for moderating temperatures and lots of rain. Castle County is going to turn green so fast in the next month that it's going to be almost miraculous. And I was thinking, you know, sort of temperate rain. Could it be maybe climate change or changes in the climate leading to changes in the environment, destroying cities? It's kind of a post-apocalyptic vision.
You didn't care for this one, though.
No, because it just didn't. It didn't do much. Because I think we were talking off, you know, mic before about the camp and the gore or whatever. And of course, I enjoy the things that are campy and gory. I also enjoy things that are thought provoking. But this one didn't really do any of those things for me.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, the only thing I can think of now from a 2019, you know, eye looking backwards, boy, it could make a commentary on the lack of health care in rural society, because God, that wasn't even an option.
Oh, that's right.
Which I don't think would have been a thought in 1982, of course, or when he was writing it even before that. But boy, oh boy.
Because he does explicitly comment, like, I can't afford to go to the doctor.
Well, and there's probably not a lot of doctors anywhere nearby him either. And that's an issue in today's society. The only thing I did pick up is on is too, is there was another the kind father. Of the father. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Shows up in the mirror.
You write about that in the post to kind of tie it to the father theme.
Yeah.
And basically his father's just telling him, right? Like, don't jump in the tub.
Yeah. Don't drink the water or get in the tub, because don't you know, Geordi, that it's just going to make things worse. And Geordi does not listen to his dad. Mm-hmm. He should have listened to his dad.
You got to carve your own path to whatever expense that is.
Well, it resulted in him blowing his head off because
he was covered in grass.
He was literally overrun.
He should have just got a lawnmower.
But so, weeds, not even the good grass. Because I feel like if it had been the good grass, there would have been like
maybe
more.
And what would be the good grass? Like Colorado?
The
is
kind
that what
you
smoke?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Just checking.
Yeah.
This really is reminiscent of The Blob, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and Stephen King had to have been influenced by that film.
And this is...
And also Superman. Doesn't
that
start with
the kryptonite? Meteor. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is one of the ones, too, because I know we're going to talk about Creepshow, the series, just kind of tangentially, because we probably don't want to give away too much, but you had mentioned that there is a nod to some of the films in this, and I wouldn't have seen it before, but this one kind of, I think it was in episode one, Grey Matter.
Grey Matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very similar.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
I mean, Grey Matter is about... somebody who gets covered by fungi.
Is that what it was? I don't know.
I think
it's super slimy and
some
weird.
Some gray slimy goo, kind of like a gray blob, as opposed to the green version of the
blob.
A weedy blob.
So we said all
that's
we
a theme.
Want to say about Geordi.
Yes.
All right. So that brings us into Something to Tide You Over, which we've already sort of discussed.
Yeah, we've talked about this.
The only other thing I would add to that is... that could possibly be another running theme is this notion of claustrophobia, because you definitely see it here because, as you were saying, you know, you're underwater and that's going to be claustrophobic. I think
but
you see
peaceful.
It in Geordi because, you know, once he becomes overrun, he's literally encased within the weeds. And I also think you see it in the crate as well.
Yeah. And then conversely, though, in creeping up on you, he goes into the panic room. Like he's always keeping himself in.
Right. Right.
Which also has themes in crate, too, because you got something that's boxed up, it gets let out, you box it back up.
Moving into the crate, which I guess we can talk about now, to give it some context, the story is about the faculty lounge ceases to be the most dangerous place on a university campus when a fanged, bloodthirsty monster is accidentally released. I have a lot of feelings about academia right now. Yeah. It might be coming across. I love this. I love this, though. I think it's such a great satire of the academy in general. But I think there is an argument to be made about the claustrophobia that Henry, who's played by Hal Holbrook, who I love, he's married to Wilma, call me Billy, Northrop, who's played by Adrienne Barbeau.
That was Adrienne Barbeau?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I missed that.
Very young. Yes. And I think a case could be made for him being, like, very claustrophobic in that relationship. Because she just henpecks him from beginning to end. So what did you guys think of this one?
Oh, I enjoyed this one, too. Just because, again, I think you had that woman that was a very strong woman. I'm not saying she was necessarily the most positive role model because she's always referring to her husband as, you know, a child. And she does belittle him a lot. And she's, for lack of a better term, pretty castrating, which why enter into a marriage if that's how you feel about somebody? Let's be honest. So she's not, like, a nice person. But it just kind of... plays with these ideas of gender and marriage and apparently academia, which we'll have to unpack too. Which can also be castrating, let's be honest.
Endlessly so.
Maybe more so than marriage. So.
I think I even made a note in my notes the first time I watched it. I was like, these academics make the shark and Jaws look like fucking Flipper.
It's yes,
they do. That's my exact words in my notes.
When I literally wrote down the same quotation because I was like, oh, you just nailed it. That's exactly it. Yeah, and the fact that it starts off and it's like sort of a faculty gathering and there's so much posturing happening and I'm like, oh, it's literally every meeting I've ever been to on campus. It made me really empathetic toward Henry, though, because I felt like Henry was just this dude who was going about his business and he's getting all of these pressure from like the dean of the college, and then he's got his wife, and then he's got his colleagues who are kind of making fun of him on the sly but not doing it directly to his face.
Yeah.
And it made me, I guess, more empathetic toward him. And
he's getting it from every angle.
Exactly. Understanding why he would choose to unleash hell on all of the people who have done him wrong.
Although it is one circumstance that instead of said academic trying to self-promote and, you know, advance their career with this mini Yeti, for lack of a better term, it is like this mini Yeti.
With super
Instead
fangs.
Of trying to present it and capitalize on it, all he thinks about is, how can I get rid of my wife?
Yeah.
Because he sees that opportunity, like, right away, right?
Well, you see him, like, having these fantasies, again, a recurring theme, of what he can do to his wife. Like, all the different ways that he could kill her. And they're pretty inventive. Yeah. And so, you know, when opportunity comes knocking, sometimes you've got to answer. But what I thought was interesting is he doesn't kill the dean. He leaves the dean just sort of in this, like, quasi-state of madness.
Well, he's killing two birds with one stone. I mean, yeah. I think he's also sort of currying favor with the dean by cleaning this mess up.
And that allows for a greater future anyway, kind of privileging his advancement later on, I guess. I don't know.
I did feel badly, though, when the janitor died. The grad student, so much, because I was fine with that. Yeah. But the janitor, I thought, I don't understand why he had to die. Yeah. The grad student, absolutely. Because we all know grad students are expendable.
Yeah.
I have a lot of feelings, people.
Well, we're grad students. I feel like we can speak to that. Whatever. There's a little class going on in there. Some class stuff going on.
Well, I have to say, like, this conversation is actually making me feel more sympathetic, not for Henry, but for his wife, Wilma, the badgering shrew. Maybe it's because you awakened my class consciousness about the lonesome death of Geordie Merrill, and now I feel bad about my my very privileged
That's
view
your first
of
mistake
him and
that I shared. Exactly.
But, you know, like, Henry wants to play the academic game with the posturing and the sort of networking his way to the top.
I think he does, but
Wilma doesn't. I mean, she's a bitch, but she's at the party just like, you know, screaming out inappropriate comments all over the place.
But do you think she has like self-awareness? Because I didn't think it was intentional on her part. I felt like she lacked all self-awareness and that she might actually think people liked her.
Yeah. I just figured she was just kind of unapologetic, which is what made her all more dangerous.
What's the Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, who's afraid of Virginia Woolf?
And
I kept thinking of, like, that dynamic, like the henpecked husband and the, like, the really bawdy. And she's always drinking, too, so maybe there is a connection there. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I wasn't sympathetic toward her, but maybe I should have been.
Because I feel like even early to mid-80s, you started to see this emergence even in sitcoms of, like, there was always a mouthy woman.
Oh, yeah.
In a lot of those, you know, not only your soaps, and I know that that's where your heart is at. Coming out, you know, out of the 70s, too, like, you had your Mauds, which then went into your Golden Girls, and you still had the same thing. You had your Designing Women. You still had some of these people that I'm sure some people had a really big problem with, especially in 1982 or before that when they were writing this.
But I feel like we should have a problem with her because she's so mean. It's not just she's emasculating, because I can be fine with that. But it's the fact that she's just really mean to this guy.
But I just feel like, put it in the 80s, if you had men having those same conversations, it would just be commonplace. And it would be like, oh, that's him. That's how businessmen are. That's just how we talk. You know what I mean?
That would still bother me, though. I think
I'm not saying it wouldn't bother you, but again, I'm looking backward, too. Like, in that time period, I feel like it would have been so commonplace that if a guy was doing it, he'd be a good old boy. I'm not saying it's right.
You mean if a man was talking to his wife in that tone of voice?
A wife, like, or his colleagues.
Okay.
Well, I mean, it's clearly playing on the trope of, like, the henpecked husband.
Yeah. Which a lot of these are. These are all
guys
that were beaten
down
by
something. Which
would
be consistent with, you know, early 80s television and movies.
You know, you can do the Jekyll and Hyde reading and that the monster in the box is really him and he's just...
That's so smart.
That's creative.
I didn't think of that.
Well, me too. I think we all just had light bulbs appear above our heads.
And that she is just like an obstruction in his path to academic success. And there is a class thing going on. I mean, the way she talks and drinks and dresses, she doesn't have the just so academic wife thing down. Mm-hmm. Now, I hated her when I was watching it. This is just me reading it after the fact when
really
I'm not
smart,
being annoyed by her.
So Dawn will be writing about this one.
I really like that,
yeah,
Jekyll
that is
and
really
Hyde, though. That actually makes so much sense.
And again, at the end, he throws the crate back in the water, which is kind of like burying that monster
exactly.
And going back to that repression. And
This one reminded me of a lot of 50s movies. Well, especially one called The monster on the campus. There are lots of creatures that are discovered. And this starts with, it's an Arctic expedition. Like, 50s movies are all about, like, discovering prehistoric monsters or irradiated monsters or things that have been long dead and that, you know, kind of wreak havoc in the present. And this was a sort of psychological version of that, sort of tying the monster to this married couple.
Dawn makes us elevated horror. I'm rethinking everything.
I'm destroying this campy little segment.
No, you're not. It makes me enjoy it again. Yeah. Like, thinking about some of these things.
But what's wild is that if we can really think about what are precursors to each one of these episodes, what the hell, Stephen King? Like, you're pulling.
But I mean, they were paying homage to a comic book.
But these aren't comic stories that he's paying homage to.
But you're always going to be influenced by something, especially when you're starting out.
But horror's like that. That's why I love it. Like, I love thinking about all the things that came before something that kind of feed into it.
Yeah.
And you can't get mad. Because I feel like our people are the people that appreciate that. Like, having that collective knowledge of everything that came before. Because we do like to revisit those things. It's like tapping back into your memories and like, oh, yeah, that's right. I loved that one. And, oh, maybe it is speaking to that. And it's just kind of this internal dialogue. Like, I don't get mad when something nods to something else. I'm like, yeah, I saw it.
Yeah. They are like little breadcrumbs to pay off people who are fans of the genre, for sure.
But you don't get mad at that. I mean, I think what you're saying is that maybe it's a little too close to Uncle Simon.
The one episode I felt like was a little too close. But I think that can also happen, too, when you consume a lot of popular culture. I think when you're trying to, like, creatively output things, I think that that actually can happen pretty easily.
Yeah.
So we still love you, Stephen King. Okay, that brings us to our fifth story, which is They're Creeping Up on You. And that is the story of Upson Pratt, a cruel businessman who lives in a sterile, hermetically sealed apartment, who one day discovers a roach and soon discovers that the roach has brought some friends. And this is body horror. This is invasion horror. And I think it's probably the most classically horror of the five. It's also the one I enjoyed the least.
Yeah, well, I wasn't a huge fan of it. And interestingly enough, too, like, just kind of with your introduction of it, there's a lot of, like, crappy businessmen in these segments.
Oh, yeah.
Which I didn't think about either. So, again, I know we mentioned class, but, like, these are the worst of the worst. Like, totally 80s businessmen.
Well, it definitely reaches a pinnacle with him because you see him browbeat a widow. Yeah. Like, that he facilitated the suicide of her husband, and he's still browbeating her on the phone. He browbeats his assistant. He's just horrible from beginning to end. There's absolutely no redeeming qualities
whatsoever. But it's bookended with Father's Day because he was that same guy.
Exactly.
Oh. Like, they are both
nasty,
nasty, rotten run.
And he is played by E.G. Marshall, who I do enjoy. So it's a good performance. Like, it's a very solid performance. But the story itself just didn't hold my attention until the very end when he was infested with the bugs and they started crawling out of his body. Ooh. And I was watching it with my grandmother, and she was like, Elizabeth, the things you watch, I just don't understand.
Kids these days.
And I was like, I signed up for. But getting to that.
So he's like a germaphobe. Like,
yeah,
I don't even think
so.
He's agoraphobic. I think it's just that he doesn't want to go out because of the germs.
Right.
Is kind of what I was taking away from it.
Right. And so having one bug is dirty. And he even says at the beginning, if there's one, there's more. And I mean, this is clearly a commentary on class.
Class, yeah.
You know.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We had a panic room in 1982. As you see, people had like fallout shelters and stuff. But this was like a straight up panic room in a skyscraper penthouse.
Yeah.
Like,
but if you were rich, you wouldn't have a panic room?
No.
That's the first thing I'm getting. Like, legitimately.
No. Really? No. I would love a panic room.
What do you envision happening that you'd need to go
into
it?
I have issues with home invasion.
Oh, this is true. You do bring that up a good amount with home invasion stories.
So I want, like, a tunnel in every room to get to my room. Yeah, I've given this thought. Mm. Probably too much thought.
I just want to get out, not further in.
Oh, no, I want to go further in.
Less too. Have you not seen the Purge movies? Like, it doesn't even work well when you get further in.
Yeah, but nothing good happens when you leave either. You know what I mean?
Sure does. You get to Purge.
That's coming back soon, the TV show.
I know,
show.
I'm so pumped about that.
But we're not talking about that. We're talking about Creeping Up on You, which I really, that's all I have to say about that.
Well, I didn't watch this one, but is there any connection between the weeds and the bugs? Things that encroach on men?
No.
I mean, he is overtaken by them in the same way. I mean, I guess it's bookends, maybe, because you have Jordy, who's, you know, one class, and then you have Upson, who's decidedly different class, but they both meet similar ends.
Okay. That's kind of interesting.
And then when you have the epilogue after that with the voodoo doll.
Oh, yes. Okay. So in the epilogue, we return to Billy's house and discover that Stan is feeling pretty poorly thanks to some intense neck pain. We then see Billy gleefully sticking pins into the voodoo doll he procured from an advertisement in his Creepshow comic. And I will say, Grandma was laughing hysterically at this point. So
good for her.
We won
Shout
her
out to
over.
Grandma.
Yeah.
Most importantly, who did you get a voodoo doll for?
I mean, probably, who did I? It was a family member for sure. I don't know.
Just bought a marble ashtray.
I don't know that I had, like, I don't think I was that psychotic, but I do remember thinking this could come in handy.
I heart you.
Really? You guys didn't have stuff like that?
I heart you. A voodoo doll? No, but you know what, guys, again, I'm going to bring it home to this. So I know that you guys can't see
us. I wish
they
could see your face right now.
Yeah, you can't see our faces, you can't see our reactions, and you don't know what we look like. But I also want to remind you that Liz just came to my house the other day in a fluffy pink sweater with a heart on it. So, just know, I love her. I love her sweaters. I love her. I love everything about you, but yeah, she had a voodoo doll for a purpose, and I'm the psychotic. At least I let you, I show my freak flag.
I mean, honestly, I feel like, see, that's funny, like watching your reactions, because I feel like that's something normal in childhood, but maybe not. Let me know, people.
I don't know.
Like, I cannot be the only one.
Dawn usually kind of regulates us. I don't know. Did you have any murders?
I did not have a voodoo doll.
Toys
or any desire to use one.
Okay.
So
there you
I
have
did.
It.
Often.
So Creepshow 2 came out 5 years later, May the 1st, 1987, directed by Michael Gornick, who was the cinematographer in the 1982 film. George Romero wrote the screenplay for Creepshow 2, but he kind of based it on, there seems to be some ambiguity about this, sort of a treatment that was done by Stephen King. And of the three segments, the middle one, The Raft, was also a short story by Stephen King. And then, so this Creepshow 2 only has three segments. Mm-hmm. There were another two planned, maybe planned is too strong of a word, but I think for budget reasons, they never got into the film. Though, Gwen, you said one of them?
Yeah, Cat from Hell ended up in Tales from the Dark Side, which is a good segment and, of course, a great film.
There are three segments, Old Chief, Woodenhead, The Raft, and then The Hitchhiker. Very quickly, what they're about. Old Chief Woodenhead is set in a sort of western town. There's an old couple that runs a grocery store in Dead River, and it is a dead town. No business. They still do business with the local Native Americans, the older generation. The younger generation turns out to be not so friendly with the white people. The second segment is The Raft. Just four teenagers go out on a raft. It's September or so, and there's a weird oil slick that gloms onto them. This is visually very much like The Blob. And then the last one, The Hitchhiker, a rich woman, kills a hitchhiker. She's white and the hitchhiker is black. She kills him with her car, but he's not dead. And the rest of the story is about his not being dead.
Now, I mean, we still have a prologue and an epilogue and stuff, but I don't think I saw as many overarching themes that tied any of these together. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you guys. Kind of different. I mean, they might have tied a little bit to some of the themes in Creepshow 1, but I don't know if I would have seen a common thread through the three of these stories.
Well, I kind of thought maybe there was.
Okay.
I mean, I think they're about like oppression and oppressed groups. Mm. I mean, Old Chief Woodenhead is, I mean, and I'm saying that because I don't think they're about gender so
no.
much. Like, first Creepshow was really about gender, masculine power, patriarchal power. Here we, you know, the first story is about Native Americans and white people in a dying western town. The Hitchhiker is about, you know, rich white people who drive through the landscape running down, you know, hitchhikers of color.
It's not like she picked him out of a lineup, though. It's not like she was like, go for the black hitchhiker.
But it just turned out that way. I have to say, I mean, and that reminds me of The Great Gatsby, you know, like the famous scene of the white woman running down somebody. And actually, have you guys ever read Bonfire of the Vanities?
No.
By Tom Wolfe? That I was sure this was playing on that novel, but that novel came out in 1987 also, so it may even have come out after. But, you know, that famously sort of starts everything with a rich white person running down a poor, I think, an African-American.
Thing with running over people in horror movies, too. Like, isn't that I Know What You Did Last Summer, too? And
Drag Me to Hell, I think, is about that.
A lot of rich white people that need their licenses revoked.
It is a really common theme.
Yeah, I never thought about it.
It's a subgenre, people.
It is. We've just created it.
We just need a catchy name for it. And then I think The Raft is about the oppression of... Well, it's about... That is eco-horror.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the revenge of the oil slick.
Yeah. I think we mentioned that one in some of our eco-horror lists or something, too. I agree.
It's a brownish color. So we've got the brown Native Americans, the brown oil slick, the brown African-American hitchhiker.
It made me think of the poor Exxon Valdez.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyone know when that was?
Like 87, maybe?
Somewhere around then.
Oh, well, same
year. There was a good amount of oil spills around
there. Yeah, that's true. That was a whole thing.
Because I feel like, wasn't it in the original story that maybe a meteor had happened? I feel like it was something a little bit more sci-fi in the story rather than in the movie. Because I feel like I remember reading that, but it's been so long. Hmm. In this one, it comes across, this is an oil slick, and it is back for revenge against these youthful, carefree...
Totally clueless,
clueless teenager.
There were some like really weird moments, though, in that like when he basically sexually assaults her at the end, it's such a strange, it comes out of nowhere, and it's such a strange moment, and that made me think, like you were saying, about 1980s sensibilities versus watching today.
Because it's so in the gross, 80s, because it would have been common at that time. It's so gross, but it's
been think about all the comedies. Who is it, John Hughes? Like, there's so many examples of that.
Although, is it that different? I literally came out of Wawa today and there's a Jeep with a big sticker. Like, out of everything that you could buy to put a sticker on your car, it says shorts up, tops down. And I'm like, please no.
You don't like my new sticker?
Shut up, Liz. I hate you. I hate you. But I'm just like, really? Like, the real joke was the size of his penis in those small yellow shorts, even before he got in the cold water.
I was just going to say, it's shrinkage. Nothing from Seinfeld. Shrinkage.
Now might be a good time to back up and say which one we liked most and least or hated.
Yeah, she always reels us in.
That's a good thing.
I'm a wholehearted hitchhiker fan. Hands down, one of my favorite skits out of horror films, period. I love it.
So that one is my least favorite.
Of course it is. Because we have nothing in common. I don't even know how I know you.
I think The Raft, probably, out of these, would be my favorite. Although Old Chief Woodenhead, I thought it held my interest a lot more than The Hitchhiker. The Hitchhiker, I just kept looking. I was like, are we done yet?
Yeah,
it's just, exactly. I just get a best friend necklace for you two right now.
Ignore. Because... Biffles.
I've clearly become the third wheel.
It's fascinating to me, though, that you do like The Hitchhiker.
Because it's so over the top and it's gory. Like, the very end of it, this bloody mess of a man climbs in her window and licks her face repeatedly. That is just gold.
When you put it like that, that's a little disgusting.
Gold.
I'm not sure I saw the licking.
You didn't know. It is just so in her face that it's just blood and it's disgusting. And he just keeps coming back and she's horrified. It's everything.
But it's so repetitive. Yeah. For me, anyway. Yeah. And I think I would have been more interesting. I wanted to see it play out with her husband and her.
Yeah.
I thought that could have been interesting. But it's
literally... think about it. Even, if something horrible like that happens in your life, you just replay it. You're going to replay it for the rest of your life. So, I mean, I guess I didn't see anything. It's
trauma.
Gonna haunt you.
Trauma. Drink.
I didn't see a huge issue with it. Plus, I wanted to see him keep coming back in different ways. I wanted to see him jump up from underneath the car. I wanted to see him jump through her sunroof.
I have to say, what was interesting about the segment to me is that it wasn't trauma. Like, I don't think she wasn't traumatized. And I think that's why he keeps coming back, because
she's such an entitled jerk.
Yeah, she really.
It's a choice.
I mean, in all of these narratives where someone hits and kills someone with their car, they're like, they are traumatized. And they're like, oh, my God, what am I going to do? Like, even in I Know What You Did Last Summer, like, there's a sense that that was a traumatic event for those kids.
It does serve like a haunting in those cases. This, you're right. I think the biggest concern is she was still trying to figure out what lie she was going to tell her husband when she was cheating on him.
Yeah.
And how she damaged the car. How much these things were going to be.
Yeah, how much it was going to cost.
And the fact that she couldn't shake the case.
Yeah.
Like, so how dare I not be so entitled.
Yeah.
And just get away with all this stuff.
So it was just pure conflict.
It's out of touch.
It was like, she was rich and didn't care. And the hitchhiker was like, you're not getting away with it. And he just kept coming back and coming back and coming back. And yeah, so it wasn't that interesting to watch, but it's an interesting point.
So is there a theme of just... Yeah, you're not going to get away with it through these.
It's so pure nature's class saying to the struggle,
saying to these careless kids, you're not going to get away with it. You know, you have these, this fighting back against these Hollywood obsessed kids in Chief Woodenhead, and then you have same thing in The Hitchhiker. So maybe
Oh yeah, well that is. Gosh, I didn't even think about that. Yeah. You don't think we're supposed to feel any sympathy for Sam White Moon? And this is the young Native American who robs the elderly white couple who own the store. And it's been clear that his uncle, Benjamin White Moon, and the older people in the local Native American tribe owe a lot of money to the storekeeper. I guess they've been buying things on tab. And so there's a kind of weird, the older Native Americans owe these white people. Sam White Moon just comes in and robs the store. Are we not supposed to feel like...
I think maybe I would feel a little bit more that way if it wasn't that he was so Hollywood obsessed and so self-absorbed. Because he was like, look at this body. Look at this hair. Oh, God, if he stroked his hair anymore, I couldn't. And then, he was like, I'm going to be famous. I'm going to be on Hollywood. So he was just this clueless, self-absorbed person, just like that white lady in Hitchhiker.
Yeah.
So I think if you would have removed that, I would have been like, oh, okay. Maybe I could see that argument.
I don't know, though, because I feel like they were very specific in how they positioned the white couple. Yeah. Like, he's very clearly, I don't want to take this. Yeah. You don't owe me anything.
Yeah.
But I think the fact that he wants to steal from his own people... That, to me, is what separates him. Right. Yeah. So if he was just stealing from them, I could definitely see an argument to me, babe. But I don't know.
The couple that owned the store remind me. What was that show? This Old House or something like that? Oh, I can't remember. They were just so they were just so, grandparently. And just
the Waltons?
Just benign. I don't know. They were just so simple and kind. The good old days.
The good old days. The woman seems... like she might be slightly suspicious of the Native Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, and she's telling her husband, don't give those people anything else. But she comes around, at the end. So you're right. I mean, they seem to be kind of model white people.
And as soon as she comes around, she gets shot.
Yeah, she gets shot.
That's what you get, lady.
But yet another wife sort of picking at her husband.
Yeah.
Like the poor put upon husband.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, these poor white men.
I know. They struggle
so. Yeah.
But I thought it was interesting that the Cisco Kid was on TV, that is not something that I ever watched. It was before my time. I guess it was a TV series from 1950 to 1956. And it was playing on TV in Old Chief Woodenhead. And then in The Raft, the two boys, Deke and Randy, called each other Cisco and Pancho.
That's right.
From this TV series. So that seems like it must be significant. I'm not sure how.
It's from the 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Cisco Kid and Pancho, I guess, were like Mexican caballeros who robbed people. They were kind of Robin Hood figures.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sam White Moon could be that kind of figure, but yeah, you're right. He's not. He's just an evil, narcissistic, Hollywood-obsessed kid.
His hair and his body isn't that cute.
I mean, the hair was impressive to me. I mean, he took years to grow. But
Charlie's Angels did it better.
I like the slow-mo shot, but it was, I mean, a little on the nose that he winds up scalped. I mean, yeah. I don't know how I felt about that. Yeah. And then, like, literally the bloody scalp is in Chief Woodenhead's hands at the conclusion.
Well, but it was interesting in a short horror segment to see that it wasn't just, like, black and white when it came to race. You know, they were trying to make it more complicated. Like, there was tension between the elder and younger Native Americans. That was kind of interesting. And then in the raft, I don't know what to say other than, it's like, it's an oil slicks revenge on.
And I mean, Liz, you said you liked this one better than the others. What specifically did you like better about it, I guess?
I like the fact that, to me, it was kind of a little bit psychological because this one was crafted in such a way that I found myself thinking, okay, what would you do? And the first thing I'm thinking is, well, they're going to be freezing when night hits because they're still wet. And do you push someone else in to be eaten by the, you know, blob and then make a run for it? Which I think is what one of the characters does before he's sort of taken out or like thinking about.
That's what Randy does.
Yeah, because he's like, I know I'm faster.
Or Deke,
Is it Deke? Yeah, I know I'm faster. But I was thinking about that because once you saw like it was busy eating one, I'm like, well, why don't you just
pick? That's kind of what the last guy tries to do. I mean, after he crudely sexually assaults this girl, her face gets stuck to the raft. Yeah. He used that as an opportunity.
But I don't think so that was in his initial intention until he realized.
Yeah.
It would kind of be like being in a fire and like trying to run out when someone else is on fire.
Yeah. Right? No, that's not peaceful too, Liz.
No, that's not. Unless you die by smoke inhalation.
People, I have this research.
Mostly do.
You have thoughts on all of it. How do you sleep at night?
I send emails at like 3 o'clock in the morning.
A lot just goes through your head, I guess. I don't know.
It does. You didn't think about this stuff as a kid?
No. Possibly killed other people in my head.
I would think about
because I wasn't planning. No, I'm not. I'm never dying.
Okay, well.
How does being dissolved by a giant purposeful oil slick rate in the
pulling your face through the floorboards.
Rankings
well,
of death.
Only because the first person who dies is like, it hurts. Mm. I was like, oh, then you don't want to go that way.
Yeah.
No pain. That's my that's
down
my
at
motto.
The bottom of the list.
Or getting mowed down by a rich white lady in the next segment.
I mean, if it takes you out completely.
I adore you.
It's interesting, actually, a commonality that I hadn't thought of because I was just looking at my notes. And, you know, the final male who swims to shore while his girlfriend is getting dissolved. He says, I beat you once he makes it to the shore. And spoiler alert, he really hasn't.
Womp womp.
That is like the hitchhiker.
Chief Woodenhead, he thinks he won when he gets out of the store.
Yeah.
Because nobody's ever going to find those bodies. He's just got rich. He's got everybody's money. And he's like, I'm going to make it off to Hollywood. Yeah. And you won't.
So these are actually very moralistic segments in that people get their comeuppances. Though the guy in the raft didn't really deserve it. He was, other than being
alleged.
Kind of does.
Maybe the sexual assault means he deserved it.
Yeah.
So I do have to ask you one final question on this, though. Creepshow 2 is absolutely categorized as horror comedy. I mean, the first Creepshow is too. And I can see some of the humor in the first Creepshow, you know, because it's some of the segments are explicitly campy. I did not find a single shred of humor in Creepshow 2.
The only one I even saw it closer would have been Hitchhiker because it's so campy over the top.
Okay.
Like, it's just not like funny haha, but it's just ridiculous, you know, with how over the top it is.
I feel like when the bullies die by the Venus flytrap, that I was laughing at. I thought that was a good moment. I enjoyed that.
Yeah. And, you know, the comic book part, maybe.
Yeah. But the humor, you're right. The humor's
funny, I never questioned it.
All right.
So I feel like at least, I will say, because I'm the only one in the bunch that watched Creepshow 3.
Yeah.
I don't really need to get into it much. However, what I will say to our loyal audience is please don't ever waste a minute of your time watching this horrific film. It is so horrific that, I mean, nobody from any of the previous creep shows was involved whatsoever. It sounds like they make that quite known. It's obvious from, you know, Soup to Nuts that there's nothing good about it. The comics are stupid. The animation is stupid. The stories are stupid.
You took one for the team.
Yeah, I did. I told you, I got halfway through. I'm surprised I even got halfway through before I had the thought, I should please turn this off.
Are there any, like, good actors in it? Just out of curiosity? Nobody?
Like, no. So you kind of have this, you have these possessed, like, electronics. You know, there's five segments. The first one, you know, they use a remote control to keep changing this girl Alice's life. She's an entitled little shit. Nobody likes her. The second segment, there's a possessed radio that speaks to this guy and tells him to kill people and kind of get his own. But it's not nearly as interesting as even that five-word sentence that I just gave you. And the next one is it's called Vampires and Call Girls, but it was kind of like something like the movie Doc Hollywood on Quaaludes. This guy that gets stuck at a free clinic, and he's a douche of a... He's just a douche canoe, and he just ingests substance and he goes to parties with vampires, but it's not even close to something like a Bordello of Blood, which is awesome.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
Yes. Then you have the fourth one, which is called The Professor's Wife, which he builds.
Academia again.
It is academia again. Yes.
Cesspool.
He builds his own wife, and he's got these annoying grad students that. Yeah. And then the last one, the haunted dog, that I don't even remember what happened in that segment. It was that bad. I think I probably fell asleep or took my own Quaaludes.
So oh, wow.
Please do as Stephen King and George Romero did and distance yourself from that. But I guess we should also, too, then go into the better stuff, which is the Creepshow TV series that's currently on Shudder.
Which I have not seen at all. So tell me on the experience. Is it worth it?
Yes.
Oh, that's good.
Okay. It's not as good as the movies in my like, I like the movies way better.
Yeah.
I'd say that each of these episodes gives two stories, and you can usually count on the fact that one of them will be good.
Though I think in episode one, I think both of the segments are good. Gray Matter, which is based on the Stephen King story of the same name. And House of the Head, which is actually based on a story by... I'll have to get back to you. God, and I read it.
It was a really good segment. I loved that one.
Yeah.
Maybe. Even if you guys haven't seen it, Google it, because the House of the Head was... It was an interesting comic.
It is weird.
Yeah. Like, I never had seen something quite like that before.
Yeah.
Oh.
Like, I found myself just kind of drawn to it. I was like, what's going to happen next? And I haven't had a moment like that in a while where I was just like, okay, well, where's this going? This is kind of odd.
Oh, I definitely want to watch that.
Yeah.
It's basically about a girl who gets a dollhouse, and she has, there's a little family in her dollhouse, parents, son, dog. And then one day she sees a severed head in the dollhouse. And
I'll have to watch it, because one of my favorite books growing up was The Dollhouse Murders.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
We need
Not
to talk.
Shocking. And I had a dollhouse, and I would, oh, you know what? Never mind.
I'm going to start singing The Best of Friends from the movie Fox and the Hound for you, too.
Fox
and the Hound. Yes. Oh, my God.
Did your voodoo doll ever?
Voodoo doll to your years doll later.
Okay.
Dawn, you brought up that they do have little ties to the Creepshow.
Yeah, they do.
Movies.
It's fun to watch.
I didn't pick up on before.
It's fun to watch the call-outs, I think. Because in House of the Head, in an effort to sort of battle the power of the severed head in the dollhouse, the girl buys an Indian figure, which goes back to Chief Woodenhead.
And we already talked about Gray Matter, kind of nods to, you know, the Geordie story.
Geordie Barrel.
Oh, that's cool.
In the second episode, Bad Wolf Down, I don't know what the hell that nods to. It's not,
yeah, no,
not much
that,
of anything.
That was bad.
That was the bad one out of the two. But the finger is interesting. I would call that more of a horror comedy, that episode. It was odd, but I was not disinterested.
Boy, that's a glowing review. I was not disinterested.
I didn't know what was quite hitting me in this one, but I consumed it, and I would have asked for seconds. I'm okay.
Just wanted to get back to The House of the Head. It was written by Josh Malerman, who wrote Bird Box.
Oh.
So.
Yeah, and then episode 3, which just aired this week, was All Hallows Eve and The Man in the Suitcase. And I know, Dawn, you haven't had a chance to watch that yet, but The Man in the Suitcase, I really enjoyed that story, too. So I definitely recommend watching it. So I guess
I would, too.
We could at least say, you know, we enjoyed Creepshow 1, Creepshow 2, and we're going to bookend it by saying watch Creepshow the TV series on Shudder.
Yes. Except for Bad Wolf Down.
Yeah, except for Bad Wolf
We've
Down.
We've done that work for you. You don't have to watch it.
Well, anything else to say about Creepshow? Or have we...
I don't know anything.
I think we did this as thoroughly as we did the Piranha franchise.
That's right.
So, yeah.
Well, thanks for listening, guys. Please follow us on all things social media at Horror Homeroom, and we will talk to you later.
Bye.